Okay, ready to go.
The following interview is being conducted as part of the Mille Island Museum of History's Veteran History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We're interviewing Dr. Charles D. Smith, date of birth February the 16th, 1919, at Damascus, Virginia. My name is William Birdsong, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Mille Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Dr. Edgar Johnson, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Dr. Smith, what was your period of service?
I served from February the 6th, 1942, until March 27th, 1945.
And in which conflict?
World War II.
And what was your rank?
I retired as a first lieutenant.
And where did you serve?
I served in the European Theater of Operations.
Could you tell us about your enlistment, why you decided to enlist, and how old you were?
I was 22 when I was enlisted, and I enlisted because my friends and neighbors selected me, and I was drafted.
And had you gone to college by then?
By then I had finished college and had taught school in high school for a year and a half.
Where was your basic?
Basic training was Camp Wheeler, Georgia. Macon, Georgia.
Tell us a little bit about basic training and the people that you were with.
Well, the first thing I learned about the people was that I asked myself the question, why are we going overseas to fight foreigners? Well, these people, I was brought up in the community of hillbillies in southwest Virginia, and I never had seen foreign people like these, and particularly guys from Brooklyn. I couldn't understand a word they said. Maybe they couldn't understand what I said either. It was rugged training, in that we got up early in the morning and went to bed late at night, and it was always something to do every minute of the day. And it was strange. First thing they want to do, they want to knock any individual out of you. We changed uniforms the first month or so, two or three times a day, just to get us used to the fact that we were in the Army. We were a service number, and that's all. And that was necessary. It did mold the unit together, and that was very important later on. At the time, I thought it was stupid. And the weather there in Georgia, it rained all the time, and it was very humid, and they had mosquitoes that could carry you off. I remember it being a very hard time, but the folks you ask about, one of my best friends was a kid from Chicago named Marks, and he went overseas to show the closeness. We corresponded for a year and a half after he went overseas. My company joined the 1st Division. They went into North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. And he went to OCS later and was killed in January of 1944. The last letter I got from him. And at the Arno River Crossing. I think by that time he'd gone to OCS and he was assigned to that Texas Division that got chopped up there. I think it was the 35th, could have been the 36th. And the thing that I learned there, which was very important, that the name of the game is survival. And it's those people you're with. That's all you got. That's all you're gonna have. And that paid off. The Army training I thought was magnificent, considering we hadn't been in a war for a long time. I'm talking too much.
What did your family think about you joining the service? Had they had military experience?
They thought it was perfectly normal. My people came into Southwest Virginia about 1750. Eddie fought Cornstalk up there at the Battle of Point Pleasant, 1774. They fought Dragon Coup, the Cheyenne chief down there at the big battle in the Holston River, the Battle of Long Island. My grandfather fought in the Spanish-American War. He was a trooper on the Western Front during the Indian Wars. Met my grandmother out there in the West, and I don't remember exactly what the time frame was. As I grew up, I cut my teeth on the fact that my great uncle Felix Duff, he died at the Battle of Cedar Mountain, which was the opening battle of the second battle of Bull Run. I had his musket, which he left at home, of course, when he went into the 37th Virginia Infantry, which was from Washington County, our county, and we lost about half of our guys in that outfit because they went all the way through the war with Lee. My grandfather, great-grandfather, Wes Blackburn, he fought all the way through the war with the third Tennessee Cavalry. He was captured at Vicksburg Parole. Because he went, as soon as he was swapped or whatever, he went right back. He ended the war being captured up in the North Carolina mountains. Meanwhile, and he finished the war, Cat Chase. As Confederate cavalry, you owned your own horse. So when they let him out of Cape Chase in that spring of 65, they gave him his horse. And he came home. Of course, he was from Johnson County, Tennessee. Most of the people in Tennessee were Yankees and fought in the war. So he came back and he said, "Wes, went off and fit 4 years, got your ass whooped. What did it ever do for you?" And he said, "I went away riding a horse, and I come back riding a horse, and that's more than a lot of them done." So there was that, it was natural what you had to do.
Well, after basic training, what was your first assignment?
Well, after basic training, my first assignment was OCS at Fort Benning, 2nd Lieutenant in the United States Army. And I graduated in October of 1942 as a 2nd Lieutenant Shavetail. My outfit went overseas. I wanted to go overseas, but the major was head of the battalion. There were three of us who had graduated from college. Came in and he said, "I've asked you guys three times to volunteer for OCS. I have a quota. And you've graduated from college. You've shown leadership. So it's up to you. You're obligated for you to go." And he said, "Those who want to go, volunteer to go at OCS, one step forward, nobody moved." He said, "I want to tell you guys something. I'm here. Do you think I don't want to go? Do you think I want to be stuck here? I'm stuck now for the second round. And you're going to stay with me as long as I'm here." And he said, "You people know something about the Army. Those volunteering to go with CS, one step forward." And I did it. And it was what I should have done.
Was OCS much different in the training?
No, it's very similar because it was all day long. You didn't have anything to do except do what they ask you to do, and you're supposed to be studying at night, which I don't think we did a hell of a lot of. And it was a little bit different in that you have non-coms, all people who've shown leadership to be there. You have a clip level of people that you didn't have, just the normal draftees. So you made friends there, very close. One was a guy named, what the hell was his name? I can't forget it. Anyway, he graduated from Yale. And after the war, when I went to Harvard, I called and told him I'd gone to Harvard. And the first question he asked was, what in the goddamn hell are you doing, a hillbilly like you, going to Harvard? So he remembered me as a hillbilly, and I remember him as a stuck-up giggly. But we formed a group of friends then, and I've only seen two of them since. One was out in Oklahoma after the war. He went in the paratroopers, tried to get me to go in the paratroopers. But it was the OCS class of 76. We had about 200 people graduated.
Well, when you graduated, what was your assignment after that into the
market? Well, because I'd been a teacher, they sent me to special service school at Fort Meade, Maryland. That was a crazy setup. You had the Army Specialist Corps had been founded to try to get the musical people, artists, and all that to contribute, not in an active military role. And captain at that time, later he became major, Glenn Miller, we had to teach him right face and left face. And the thing I remember most about that school was when the graduation exercise took place, we put on an entertainment for our teachers. Glenn Miller played trombone, led the band. The man on the piano was some guy, Rubenstein, who's supposed to know something about playing the piano. And the man who put on the place, the thing was one of those Schubert boys from Broadway. And so there were three of us who were kind of hillbilly, so we put on a skit. And we sang the old hillbilly songs, particularly Mountain Dew. Rubenstein played it, and we sang it. Could only happen in a war. Could only happen of that magnitude. And the only trouble with special service was they put it on your record. And when you went to a battalion somewhere, that any kind of a detail that remotely resembled special service, you got it. I always thought I was picked on, and I went back over and checked those assignments and realized that I would have done the same thing.
How long were you there at that assignment?
I was there about, I think that class was a month, was about, so we were there about 6 weeks. And by that time I was married, so that was the first assignment in which I had my wife with me. And we were right close at the racetrack there at Maryland. I don't know what it is. Every time I see them running that race, I think about that time.
How did she adjust to the Army?
Real well, except she didn't understand why we couldn't be together more. She didn't understand. You got up. You know what it is. You stand. You exercise or whatever the hell, I've forgotten what it is. At maybe 5 or 5:30, and you knock off maybe 6 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, I'd say. And she didn't. I don't think she ever understood that. I don't think the guys like me in it really understood that, but why you had to spend all that time later on, I guess maybe it was important. So she had a hard time adjusting, I'll say that, but she stuck with me then, and she's stuck with me the rest of these years. Our 65th anniversary is coming up next April.
Where did you go from there?
I went from there, I guess, you won't believe what I'm going to tell you. We went to a place in Arkansas, Cape Smith, I think, or anyway, which was a Rapple Dapple replacement depot. And I showed up at the company. We had 12 lieutenants. And being dumb, I didn't know what the hell was going on. But we had the troops were the people who were drafted. We must have been desperate at times because those guys were physical misfits from the word go. And they had to fire. You know how the Army is. You've got to fire one round. Everyone in the Army has to fire one round. Now, some of those guys were so skittish and uncoordinated that it took a lieutenant, me, and a sergeant, one holding the head and one holding the thing out, so that they wouldn't shoot anybody. But everybody shot one round. The one thing about the Army was not, they didn't kowtow to anybody. There were no favorites. We were up in Wisconsin later time, and you could fire if the temperature was zero, anything less than zero. And we would get out there at maybe 5 or 10 below zero and pray for that zero so we could do something to keep warm. But the Army said it. No exceptions. And that was important. That was important for a person to learn that the rules, everybody had to go by the same rules. Very important. And you got that. They had to knock out of you the individuality in the terms of you not being a member of the team. And I think it did a magnificent job in doing that, but at the same time not curbing the leadership of the guys, because, man, when this man went down, somebody else. You went sergeant to corporal, but when you went from there, the guy knew, and they knew who the leader was. That was our success.
Well, was Wisconsin your next assignment from Arkansas?
Yes, and I was so stupid. My wife wanted to know where we're going. They told me that you have a secret. You are not to divulge any destination, anything in these orders. I didn't tell her. Now, you know that was stupid. That was stupid. But I had to learn. You get an order, you obey it. And we went to it. And I don't think she's ever forgiven me for that, and I don't think she should. God, we went up there, and it got down at times 20 and 30 below zero. And she, I don't know what she had to wear. She had to buy galoshes and that sort of thing. It was, it was being, I think, the civilian training to get from that to fighting a war. We made a tremendous transference, I think. I think what we're going through today, we have to go through a similar type transference in their thinking from some guys that are going to stand up and fight as to terrorists. We've never had any experience in that. Matter of fact, I don't think we've ever had the experience in training people to think. They taught us to think, and it paid off.
Was your next assignment overseas from there?
From there, I went overseas. That is correct. And we left New York in September of 1943. Went to Northern Ireland and stayed there until the spring of 43. We went September 43, went overseas, and in the spring we went to Wales. The 28th Division was supposed to go in on the invasion. They had all the amphibious training that you could speak of. Our training in Wisconsin, ski troops. We were going in on the west. It's just the Army. You guys know that. We went in to Normandy with no amphibious training. None of our men had ever climbed over those nets. The reason I found out later on, and this is my guess, is that the 28th Division was Bradley's division. That's when he made his fame in the Louisiana maneuvers. And for some reason or other, we were put in their place. Before that time, we were in Patton's army, his paper army. And let me at this point make a difference in Bradley and Patton. Patton, we drew up the division in Armagh, Northern Ireland, and bricks and all that stuff. They called the attention when he got up on the platform to speak. They called the division to attention. He spoke, but he didn't speak very long. I'll give him credit for that. And he used that same language that was used in the Patton movie. He talked exactly that way. He had us open ranks so he could get in his jeep and go and look every man in the eye, which he did. Right by here, back. And I'll never forget the sound of the helmet. You know, when you faint, you don't have any arms. There's no. And what hits first is that head. And you got the helmet, and the thing would go bonk, 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 bonk. But he looked every man in the eye. And he said what the job is and talked to us, just like he did that. Whoever made that movie got him down pretty good. Bradley, when we went into Normandy, we had a sand table. All the officers and non-coms had a sand table of Omaha Beach. Showed exactly the way it looked when we got there. And emplacements and that sort of thing. And when we had each company, Bradley talked to each company that was going in on the invasion. That was the 1st Division, the 2nd Division, and the 29th Infantry. He talked to each company. And the difference in him and Patton, night and day. He said, "All right, men." And he sat down, instead of standing on the platform, sit down. Down on his leg. He said, "All right, now move in." He got cigarettes, he got smokes, light them up. And he talked to us on a very informal basis. But his message was the same. "It's you're responsible. It's up to you." And I have confidence, same speech exactly without the language. But it showed the differences I think we had, not only in those two generals, but in our men. We were fortunate. We were just absolutely fortunate. I remember November of 1942. There is no way to describe to people. When people never talked about the war being over. There's not a stop. It wasn't worth talking. People talked about the wars. In the duration, 6 months thereafter, duration of the war. No one ever thought the war ended in terms of sitting down and conjecture about it. And everybody, in a sense, knew somebody and was involved. When I went into Normandy, I've tried to explain this to people, but when we got off of the personnel band, you felt something behind you. Something was pushing you. And I don't know what it was, but I think it was being an American and knowing this is our show. It's marvelous. And I was in combat about 6 weeks. I told somebody that, and they said, "That's not very long." I said, "God damn it, it's long enough." That we were under small arm fires all the time, and we had not one desertion. Not one. And when I went in, we had 40 men. They gave us 10 supernumeraries, is what they call them, And everybody going in went in over strength because they expected a lot of killing and they got it. Now, I did not land on the D-Day. Our company was loaded on an LST, and I was upstairs watching. And what they describe about the destroyers going, you know, and firing up there, I could see that in my glasses. And I tell you, I was never a religious guy, but I think everybody in our company was praying because we got the word, you know, the boys were bad and so forth, and it looked like we were going to have to go in. And I think that's the first time I had prayed since I was a kid. And you knew you were part of something. What amazed me, the battleship. I don't know which one was there, but I've never seen a battleship before. And when those guys would fire, boom, then that ship would roll back, and I think that son of a gun's going to bolt. It's going to sink. And then when it came down level, guns fired again. And that was, to me, a marvel. I just couldn't figure how in the hell that is. So that I landed on early morning, June the 7th. Beach had been secured, but all the debris was there, and the bodies lined up and all this sort of thing. And no artillery, no small arm fire, but we got artillery and mortars. I'll tell you, it's one thing you within anywhere close to the Germans, that's what you're going to get. And every time you attack, you're going to get a counterattack. Thank God you could count on those people. They would cover the little low ground with their mortar fire. And thank God for the Germans. Love them. What they would do, they'd come. We were detached from the battalion for a while, and we had the patrols going to the battalion headquarters back and forth. And you go up there and you stop and you wait, and here it comes. Three rounds. Boom, boom, boom. And then you just walk right across. Now, an American guy on the mortars, I'll tell you how he would do. He'd say, well, we haven't had one in a while. Throw in a couple. See, they couldn't count on us. And we went, and when you come back, same thing. Stop there and wait. You may have to wait a long time. You come in, boom, boom, boom. Go across.
How long were you on the beach before you were able to get out?
They were moving us out real fast. That was a marvelous job. I don't know who that guy was, but he got us, and he had a hard time because the LSPs, they did about 30 or 35, and I had 50. So he had to get us together. Did a marvelous job. Absolutely, I'm telling you. Americans should do anything. That was marvelous. And then we moved off the beach, and the problem we had was this. For whatever reason, I don't know, the 29th on our right went that way, the first went this way, and there was a 3-mile gap there. And from the time we got off the beach from there on, we were taking land from the Germans. We were under fire in effect. And that was really sucks. Well, they hadn't figured on that. And the next place where we had problem was Cerise Forest. So what has happened? They went, maybe they looked at their damn maps. and left Frisky Forest, and right behind it was Hill 192. That was the high ground above St. Glow. Had to be taken. Because from that high ground, you could see all of the beach. And those sons of bitches were there. And they were giving our people hell all the way because they could drop their guns. That was really the linchpin of the defenses that the Germans had in the Battle of St. Lo. Do you remember the Battle of St. Lo? Now, I don't remember all of the division, but we had the 1st, 2nd, 29th, the 4th, who had been on Utah, and whoever backed up the 4th, I don't remember who it was. That's doing a disservice because I should know that. We lost, the division lost 2,000 men. We had 18,000. Of course, we didn't have 18,000 in getting up there, getting their ass shot off, but, pardon me, it's 2,000. In my first, not my first attack, but in one of my attacks, I lost 27 men. Because we got up on that, you know, a couple of times we got up and got almost to the top of that thing, but couldn't make it. I lost 27 guys. Most of them killed because they couldn't get down and we couldn't get to them. And the one thing that has bothered me through the years is those 10 guys who were new didn't know these guys. These guys had been together for a couple of years or more. Some of them had been in the Army all their life. They didn't know. And those kids, well, 9 months before that, they were at a prom somewhere, and the only worry they had about making out, I guess. And the guys who knew each other, it wasn't that they froze them out. It just they didn't have any more energy than to cling together. And I know that some of those guys died thinking I was a son of a bitch, which, of course, I was. We had Calvados, which is cognac, made out of apple. And the guys got some of that and got high as a kite. I had to go up with my sergeant. I broke the stuff because he's with those guys. They can call me a son of a bitch and desire with me. Broke the stuff and told them if they ever did got any more that they were going to, because we were on this constant contact. Sometimes we were as close as 100 yards because they had these hedgerows. And we were terrible mistaken. They didn't understand. Now, we didn't understand, so I can't. The hedgerows were dirt around the fields. And growing out of the top of those hedgerows were the trees, you know, so that and you couldn't use tanks. There was no way. Later on, we developed a flogger or something, but it was just what you had to do was to go a field at a time. And shall I tell you this? This is going to be criticism of the Army, and I don't think I should repeat it, but it bothered me because some ass said 4th of July 1944, we want every man on the front line to fire a bullet in celebration of our independence. Now, I don't know who put out that order, but any time you fired against those guys, buddy, you're going to get it all that you can handle back. And some people are going to get killed. I disobeyed a law order, and they can come and court-martial me if they want to. Told my men no. Because we were up there where a lot of times you had urine, you didn't have hot water. And you had those M1s, you know, the gas port on that. You're okay. But if that gas port gets fouled up, You're in bad shape, and our men all the time were clearing to be certain that gas port. And here's some ass saying, you know, one of five. That's, I think, in a way that shows the way we are in America. We lean over backward to be nice to people because we're sentimental. Thank God we are. But I don't know what the company commander thought about it, and I didn't care. See, I'm being noble now. It's easy for me to do that. The one event, and you want to hear an event that's important to me. I had one attack. I had my 50 guys, and we had a weapons platoon in which they had machine guns, section of two groups, two crews, and three sections of mortars. And they assigned the machine gun section to me. The sergeant in charge was Sergeant Peeler, a man I'd known for a long time. And when we went and attacked, Peeler was with my platoon headquarters, and I had to move forward, and there was a gatehouse, and Sergeant Peeler and his runner went into that gatehouse. Went back to Normandy in 1988, and there was that gatehouse and that reconstruction part of it, because I said, sorry, I went in and said, you come on out, because those Germans have this all zeroed in, which they did, and they're going to blow it to kingdom come. And he said no. He refused an order. No. And I said, asked his runner to go. No. He's going to stay with his sergeant. That's certainly exactly what he should have done. And then I hadn't gone up, looked back, and boom, straight up. And my life, I blame myself. Why? But I had a platoon. I couldn't go in there and spend all that time with him, save his life. When we were moving forward, and anyway, I'm making excuses. But that's bothered me all these years, and still does. Why didn't I? Because not for me, but for him. He died thinking, his lieutenant thought he was a coward. And any man that really was in harm's way would never think anybody else was a coward. Now, I'm saying this because if I could have cut and run decently, gotten away with it, I could sneak it by my folk at home, I would have done it. I mean, a little chunk of hell was big enough for me. And that's what I hate for him. I'll never forget that. But the point is, what could I have done? It's a way in your life. I think I'm not saying anything that you men haven't experienced. Think back over it. Why can't I do it? You'd do the same thing, people tell me, but that doesn't happen. So, I'm sorry, Bill, I've gotten to talking here, and I've taken your time. Please ask me another question.
Well, you were taking that Hill 192 at St. Lo, and that was a success.
Yes.
And then what occurred after that? Did you continue going forward?
Well, that's where I got my ass shot. We went forward. In one of the previous attacks, we had... We followed two tanks, and they bellied up. There was the Elk River. It was dry, pretty dry at that time. The Elk River right around the edge, and we were on the end, really, of the hill. That way. The hill went long that way. And they bellied up in the Elk River. We had the two tank commanders. They sent the enlisted guys back, but they stayed with us. Because they said, we go back there, we're not going to get a tank. They say, where in the hell is your tank? I said, no, we're not going to go back. We've lost our tank. So they stayed. We covered those two tanks by rifle fire so that when we took the hill and we were moving out, they had a tank pulling one of those tanks out. And the two guys who's company headquarters were down there, and they're going to take their tank. That was one of the few successes I think we had. But it was not tank country. Now, I got lost there. Where was I? Oh, you said, what did we do? Okay, we moved out. We went over the top of Hill 192, and we had our company area. So the company commander and I and his exec and the other two platoon leaders went down to reconnoitre, and we became and I sent the sergeant Calhoun platoon guide back to put the platoon in the general area where I pointed out to me as it came by, and I went back to company headquarters. Lieutenant PFC Fruit, who's my runner, he and I, we dug in two men foxholes, and we were digging in, and we were digging into the side of one of these hedgerows, back to back, and we came under mortar fire, and then they boom, 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 boom. Of course, they knew. Where we would probably have our headquarters, and they came exact right. One of the tree bursts, which is the worst, got Fruit. It blew him to kingdom come, and blasted me. And luckily, when I was digging, threw the stuff on this side, so that from my legs here, my knees, up to my neck was okay, but my head and my legs, and I got both legs there and knocked off one toe and put multiple wounds in each leg and busted my jaw, shot out some teeth, blasted this side of kingdom come, and what saved me was that, you know, you have a little old tin helmet, you pull that down, man. So I was pulling that down. And luckily, I had my wristwatch and right there at my eye. And when the thing hit, it hit at the toughest part of my head right there. You can put your finger in it. And then a piece of it came down and split my eye. So I lost my eye. But my wristwatch blasted. And the guy was looking, you know, after they took out my eye, he said, "There's a lot of debris in here. Looks like it's kind of silver." I said, "Well, of course, that's my watch," which is exactly what it was. I had a hard time ever wearing a wristwatch after that. But it saved. It saved my life. What really saved my life, though, was Corporal Crowe. He was thank God, I must have been a nice guy or something, because he wanted to stay with my platoon. The other, we had two medics. The other went to the company headquarters. And he happened to be right there. He was digging. There was a dugout place there, and he was digging in with the sergeant, platoon guide. And he came out, and he had a little syrette. I don't know how many little morphine syrettes he used, but if he hadn't used that, the shock, I think, would have killed me. Because I do remember when I'm looking what the white tendons that you had in the arm, and I just picked it up and put it over here. You see, I remembered that. Still remember that. And the thing I remember mostly, though, was his cousin. Now, he was a very religious man. He was a Catholic, but he was a religious person. Never heard him use, man, he used cuss words I'd never heard of. That's what I remember. I remember most, they killed him up at the Ardennes. I had in my platoon headquarters, I had Crow. They killed him at the Ardennes. Platoon guide from South Carolina, would you believe it? Calhoun. He was killed at Brest because the division went from there into Brest. PFC Fruit was killed, of course, with me. Sergeant Gurer was the only one of the five that came through. He later got a battlefield commission, and last time I heard he was first lieutenant. It's been 87 years, so what I'm remembering here, how true it is, I don't know. I'm just giving you some of the feelings that I've had through the years.
Where did they evacuate you to?
We went to... Are you sure you got plenty of time here? Because St. Laurent-Samir Cemetery is the place where the 15th Field Hospital was. And when they cut my arm off there, they didn't do my eye. They did that in Bristol, England. They had a corner up there for legs and arms and stuff like that. So that's there today. I went back there in 488, you know, and I thought, well, somewhere here is my arm. That was and that was right in the middle of that cemetery. All I can remember is the man saying, you're going to be all right, and I'm asking him. Now, I'm still pretty cogent. I said, what about my eye? He said, they'll take that out of Bristol, which they did. They flew us across there with a C-47, and it was in Bristol, England, for a month or so. Then we went on the train up to Ireland, up to Scotland, and they flew us out of there across the sea and to Walter Reed, and they took they had taken my eye out of Bristol, and then I stayed in Walter Reed. I had as a companion in Walter Reed Lieutenant Colonel Jacques Mertain. He had was in St. Cyr at the end of World War I, so he didn't hit the war, but he hit this one full on. He was with General Gaulle, Free French, good friend of his. He later became Lieutenant General Jacques Mertain in command of the Middle European forces, I don't know. But he was an interesting person in that he was in Italy, and of course this was the latter part of the war, and the German planes came over, and he said, this may be the last time I'm be able to hit him. He went up and pulled some second lieutenant out of the canopy, whatever it is, of the plane, and went up, and he got shot and set his plane on fire, and he tried to bail out, and he did bail out, but he got his leg hung, so he couldn't bail out in time for his parachute or something, so he just hit on the water there and crushed his leg. Very, very sensitive guy. It was weeks after they took off his leg that he found out he didn't have a leg, because he told them they couldn't take it off. And then what they did, they put him in a cast so he would think he had a leg. What a guy. Whatever.
He was at Walter Reed also?
Yes, he was. He was. He and I had a lot. He called me a grizzly bear. I don't know why. I was proper or rough for him. Great guy. Very sensitive.
Did your wife come to that area also while you were in the hospital?
Yes, she did. And when she met me, I weighed about 100, I don't know, 20 pounds. Because they shot out my teeth, and they had to wire it up. If they hadn't shot out the teeth, I wouldn't have been able to take anything. So they wired up the thing, and I'd lost so much blood that, I was down to nothing, and I was on liquid. So I was shuffling around. I was shuffling along on the... It must have been a terrible sight for her to see this guy's skeleton go. So she stayed there with me till we went on up to Valley Forge, where they gave me my new eye. And the eye is, but that time the dentist did the eyes using plastic, and before that they had a glass only. And when I came along, they'd come up with the plastic idea, which you make was very, you could make kind of a cup out of it, and it was very light. And they could do a lot more with the color somehow. So we went up, and I got my eye there, and then I went back teaching school.
Did you have a long period of rehabilitation, though, before you could go back to teaching?
Yes. You see, but I went back to I went straight back to the school where I had a contract, and I hadn't finished it. So I went back and finished that contract. Then I went under Public Law 16 to Harvard, and I was there 5 years. Because I lost this eye, and this, it was my 20/20 eye. This guy had never done any work, and he had to learn how to read, and I was, in effect, legally blind for that period of time, so it took me I did three courses instead of four, and it took me a long, long time for the reading, because I had to learn to read again what the letters looked like, because they were very, very, very faded. So I'm making a hero out of myself, which I'm not. And I was at Harvard for those 5 years. What a difference. Everybody wore coat and tie. Now get this. Everybody wore a coat and tie except the guys, Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, that worked in the laboratories. And we always envied those guys because they didn't have to wear the ties. There was discipline in those people, and they had learned it in the service.
Were most of the people veterans that you were with?
Yes. And they're wearing every description of clothes that you ever saw. Everything. they wore their army shirts, and they wore army pants with a jacket. Now we had this is not germane to the military, but a doctor, Morris, who wrote the history, naval history of World War II. Stanley, Elliot, Samuel Elliott Morris. This young man came in one time, and the heating system there, cake. He came in, and he had not put on his coat, so he must have left in a hell of a hurry, put on his overcoat. So the temperature of the room got up about 95 or something, so he opened his coat. Hey, young man, cover your bosom. Put on your waistcoat. He said, I don't have it. Oh, button up your coat. And he buttoned it. He said, I want it all buttoned. And don't you ever come to my class without a waistcoat. And that kid, you know, he's sweating like that. And he didn't take umbrage at that. He knew that what the rules were, and I remember Morrison. He was some. He always thought I was in the Navy, and he had this little Navy girl. I don't know what they call it, doing all his work. I said, "Well, you know, Mr. Morrison, he thinks I'm in the Navy." And I said, "I keep telling him." And she said, "Well, Mr. Smith, what difference does it make? If that's what he wants to believe, let him believe it. Do you care?" And I said, "No, I don't care. I just don't want a sailor in false concept. That's his problem." So I didn't after that. Never did. I went back to see him afterward. That time he had married a lady from Virginia, my old state, and he offered me a drink. He said, "You know, medically I can't drink anymore, but I enjoy it." So she had a water glass, 3/4 full of bourbon. Now, I don't know where she ever got that idea. She knew I was from Virginia, so maybe that's the way they poured them. Man, I went out of there and humming. I'm telling you, it was marvelous. That the head of orthopedics of the Army was at Brigadier General, was at Harvard Medical School. He had charge of my public law 16. You went 3 times a week for 3 hours. And I did that for the 5 years. That saved me, man. I tell you, that was marvelous. And he called me in one day and said, "Smith, this is the second report I've gotten on you. You're a good basketball player and you love to play basketball. I want you to sweat. And you got a report from your trainer that you have not been breaking a sweat. Now, this would be 3 times if I hear it again, and I'm going to tell them you are not eligible medically, be it public law 16. Now, do you understand that?" And I understood it. Now he went back and I broke the broke a sweat. But it was a different time, different. But those young men at Harvard are no different than young men anywhere else. You go anywhere in the country, they had a sameness about them. There was a certain, I wouldn't call it discipline, because Americans are not disciplined, but there was a certain air about those people. It's like this lady when Lee invaded to go to Antietam. She was a rank Yankee, but somewhere along the way she got to see these soldiers, Confederate soldiers, and she said, "You know, that's the ugliest, dirtiest bunch of men I have ever seen." But she said they had a certain air that our glorious Yankee soldiers do not have. And I thought, to me, that's the most significant description of the difference in fighting men. There's a certain air there. And it's not arrogance. It's confidence. It's words just can't describe it. It's there. You know that you're going to do the job. And I think because you know that guy's going to do his job.
Did you develop close friends amongst the veterans that were at Harvard?
Yes, I did. Let's see, what's his name? He was from Kentucky. Got to know him real well. The guy that was the head of the history department at Yale. His name is Elfmist. Had a professor, Perry Miller. Perry Miller wrote the New England Mind. He was a brilliant guy. He was in the Army's strategic service they had, but it was a prerequisite or whatever to the CIA. And he was responsible for the propaganda that they put out to the Germans. And he was so proud of that, you know, but he lacked that. He suffered from positive spirit, as far as I'm concerned. The way he treated a friend of mine, and I won't go into this because this is not any of your business, but he asked about it. Then I wasn't very nice. I told him that the paper was good for only one thing, and we did appreciate it. I said, if I ever meet one of those guys, just tell him who you are, and that they used the Perry paper. That was mean, but you got to be a little mean to survive.
Well, your field was history at the time, is it?
Yes, history.
Did it relate to the war?
You won't believe this, but my American history was a game, and I wrote about the creation of Eastern National Forest, because our land in the mountains there, the people came in and bought up the land. The government cut over land and made the national forest. And I often wondered how that happened and why they had the right to come in and buy up the old home place. So I wrote that thesis on the creation of Eastern National Forest. And I really enjoyed that because it had meaning to me. My folks came in there and the old place there was going down. He was taking charge of it. He was in charge of it, and he had this guy take care of it. So we'd go up there once in a while and take a look at the old place, and my father would tell stories of the family. Her family was the Ketterings, the Germans, and the Duffs. And the Ketterings name got changed militarily, because every time war came, going back to your original question, our guys went off. And they went before the Revolution. Of course, the English anglicized that. And then later on, when you got your bonus, we got quite a bit of land finally, because our soldiers got as bounty forest land. And you had to sign. If you've been in the Army, if you don't sign exactly the way that payroll is, you don't get paid. So we didn't get our land. So they had the Kettnerings, the Ketterings, the Catrons, the Catrons, Catron, and I thought I was English because of anglicized Catron. And I don't know. I've talked too much here.
After you did your degree, though, did you stay in teaching, education?
You don't believe this, man. I don't know. You think I'm making this up. But I went to El Paso. I only had my master's degree. I still had not finished my thesis. It took me 11 years to get my degree because I just wasn't able use my eye. That's my excuse. I probably was a little lazy. But we went to El Paso, Texas. And the reason we went was because the doctor there said, hey, if you got a chance to go somewhere, go where you dry, because with your bones, broken bones, you're going to have trouble with humidity. So we went to El Paso, Texas. And I taught in the high school there. Then Korean War came, and out at the Fort Bliss there, which was the anti-aircraft and guided missile school, we're looking for people with military experience, and I had a hard time with the degrees because when I went to college and university, I didn't take any education courses, so I went out and became an instructor in aircraft and guided missile school. And we taught how to teach, instructor training. Part of that was in order to determine whether an examination is valid, you had to sit through that instruction. So I sit through mathematics, I sit through computers, I sit through all kinds of math courses and stuff, so that I had a smattering of electronics at a new time. I'm talking about 1955, 6. And so a guy from MITRE Corporation, MIT, was forming this research and engineering group to work with the Air Force. So he said, hey, come on. And we went to back to New England, and I worked for MITRE Corporation. One of the two projects we had, the anti-aircraft and guided missile school in Cheyenne Mountain. We dug that and we put that in, and we did the first first real-time computer system was the radar system up on Cape Cod. We put that in. We had this company called, there was UNIVAC and there were others, called International Business Machines Company. And you didn't call them IBM, you called them International Business Machines Company. And we set them up in the computer business. We did the retail system. We did the NORAD command system. And my role in that was in the operational requirements. The operational requirements. What data do you want to see to make your decisions, and what form would you like to have it in? And that was the area that I worked at. For instance, the mushroom cloud. I put that up there. It was the impact. I'm bragging right now, but it was a different. Now this shows the difference in Americans and anybody else that I ever knew. We took a multi-faceted group. We took mathematicians, we took historians, we took psychologists, we took economists, we took anybody that had a brain to make this system, because we didn't know what the system was. The Air Force didn't know what it was. We had to make it out of whole cloth. That's the way America operates. And we did that. And we ran into some very hard problems, which I really didn't understand. When I went to Harvard, I got history, that's all. I had the opportunity to meet some of the brightest people in the world in every area. No, I had to be just little dates and what happened. We didn't do that. Now we had, this example I'll give you, psychologists. You have clinical psychologists. You have experimental psychologists. And they do not like each other. They each think that their others in the field are useless. Now I'm making a general statement here, but it's germane to what I'm talking about. Our boss brought these two guys in. They couldn't get along. And he said, look, we're all different disciplines here. And we're not here to teach somebody else our discipline. What we're here is to take the best from all the disciplines and make a system for the Air Force that's going to work. Now, give you guys 2 weeks. If I hear that you're doing anything with cooperating, you're both fired. And that worked. and it was and it was.
Well, did you stay with them for the rest of your working career?
No, you won't believe this either. Yes, you will. I stayed there for 8 years. I think 8 years. Then a man from Raytheon came by and said, "Why don't you come work for us?" And I said, "Well, why should I?" He said, "Well, here's the thing. We got this project you might be interested in." And so he gave me the name of the project. I forget what it was now. "And we're going to give you this money and all this sort of stuff." And so I have children coming up for college, so I went. Stayed 8 years there. And I retired. After all the years in history, I retired as a principal engineer at Raytheon.
Where was this?
Raytheon.
What city, though?
Raytheon was working on the precursor of the Patriot missile. I had worked at the anti-aircraft school, and I was there when they transferred from the guns to the missiles, and I did the missile maintenance was my specialty. While I was at MITRE, the guy, colonel, asked our people for me to come by. They're going to have the Air Force maintenance manual was being rewritten. And they take people from all around the world on this maintenance manual, and they wanted someone, an expert. And this colonel says, "Well, every time I point the computer, your name comes out." And my name came out because I was an expert in the Army missile and had worked with the Bomark, which was the Air Force missile, not the big guy. So he said, I showed up and he said, "We're having these people come from all over the world. I want you to write the missile maintenance chapter for the Air Force." And that included the big boys. You know, I don't know anything about that. He said, "I don't either. But that computer tells me you do. And I'm going to give you these guys that have all the experience in the world. And they're going to do the work. You are going to write that because you know the kind of people, the operational people, they're going to use this manual." So I did that and tried to get out of it. Oh, let me tell you. But I can't. I'm not supposed to. And we weren't supposed to do that kind of thing. But anyway, he just told, "Who's your boss?" And he called on my boss. But it wasn't 2 minutes. He had my boss on the floor. He said, "You stay here as long as I need you." And I stayed there. We it was no sweat because getting back to the military runs because you have people who are able to make accommodations. I came along there and I said, "Well, wait a minute here. When I went in the field to do the, you know, the checking, I'm talking about my experience. And the sergeant said, "Look here. Here's the manual, which is written by the company that makes the missile, and you're not following that. You're doing this." And he said, "Yes, because that never worked. So we did this." So I said, "Well, now, can you write that in such a way as these people won't be insulted, but the people using that manual can use it?" And they said, "Yes." So we had some of the similar problems from these guys. We had different inputs, and each one would do it somewhat differently. So what we did was just kind of get together those Americanisms and do the job. Wonderful bunch of people.
Well, did this work influence you to becoming a writer also?
No, I think what made me a writer is ego. Because I wrote my autobiography. That's one of the first things I did. 352 pages, which is on file. It's called Maggie's Drawers. It's called Maggie's Drawers because, as you know, on the rifle range, they have the spotters for the twos and fives and all that stuff. If you miss the target entirely, they have a red flag. So you know. Then they call it Maggie's Drawers. So that's what I did, because I think that's what a lot of us get, and we read it as a five. But anyway, that's philosophy. So that's why I did that, ego. And then I wrote a lot about the mountain, the short stories, because I was always interested in it. People would listen to me, not because I knew a damn thing, but I'd tell a story. And when I was on the road with Meyer and Raytheon, those guys liked me to go because of stories. And there's no mountaineer that's not going to improve a story. You get a story, if you don't improve a little, you're not doing your job.
Well, what brought you to Fernandina at the end of all of this?
My wife. My wife has always loved the sea. Her grandfather, she cut her teeth on a yacht, a racing yacht that was built for the Bermuda races, and her grandfather owned. Wonderful little boat, I don't know, 60 or 70 feet, called the Nighthawk. It was in service during World War II as a submarine chaser with the number 2008, and it for 2 years. And eventually, they had a storm up there somewhere and sank it. But I'm answering your question. She loved the sea, and she came here. That's why we got.
When did you come to Fernandina?
We came in 1986, about 20 years ago. We've seen some changes here. You have too. Where in the heck do those people come from? I'm telling you. And they must have thought about me when they came. Wonderful, wonderful. We've got such a beautiful mix of people here. It's fantastic.
But do you have any other stories about your war experience that we didn't talk about that you would like to be sure is recorded?
Well, my experience, per se... No, I don't think my experiences were any different than anybody else other than the Public Law 16 rehabilitation. And that to me is very important. And there's one thing I would like to say to the American people who come to me, you know, because you can't hide the fact that you lost an arm. So they knew, it being World War II age, that I was in harm's way, saying how much, you know, they thanked me for what I did for them. Now, what they don't realize, what they did for me, they gave me rehabilitation at a time when I needed it, when I needed to be protected from the world and have everybody just concentrated on what I'm doing, what I and interested in me as a person. And they did that. And they gave me a degree, which gave me a leg up, which I needed after that big world, which they understand. And the Veterans Administration, Army, got a letter from the Army the other day, you know, thanking me for what I did and all that thing, and gave me a little lapel button with a star on it. And I appreciate that because they did know who I was. Never missed a check. 60-some years from the Veterans Administration of the Army because they gave a damn. Because there's something there they understand. I'm sorry. God bless you people, and God bless Bill and Ed here, taking time to talk to an old galoot.
Well, Dr. Smith, if there are no other stories, we'll go ahead and end the interview here and take a look at some of your photographs. Thank you very much for letting us speak with you and for what you have done.